Welcome to Legal Nurse Podcast, where you will get tips to expand your legal nurse consulting skills. Every week, you'll hear from experts from within and outside of legal nurse consulting. They will share their knowledge to help you grow. Your show is moderated by Pat Iyer, a legal nurse consultant with 30 years experience. So, join our community, sit back, relax, and get ready to learn. Here's Pat.
This is Pat Iyer with Legal Nurse Podcast, and I have with me today David Goodall, who I met through a joint venture conference we both participated in a few months back. Dave is a person I've been looking for a long time. He is an expert in neuro-linguistic programming, and I find that subject fascinating and wanted to bring it to you to share some pointers with you about how you can use some of the concepts in your interactions with your clients. Dave, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
I know that you just went through a significant amount of training in Florida to advance your own knowledge of NLP, neuro-linguistic programming. Can you tell our listener what you just went through?
Yeah, so I took an NLP practitioner's training through my coaching stuff a little over 2 years ago, and I just got back from Tampa, Florida, getting a master prac. So basically getting a master's certification in NLP, going into the deep-rooted details of all the concepts of NLP. I got a master's certification in therapy, hypnosis, and mental emotional release, which helps people with a lot of traumas, PTSD. Basically, MER, what we do is we remove the five major negative emotions. So a lot of my clients will start our relationships in that place, removing the emotions, because then we can start with a clean slate and start setting goals moving forward without all the baggage.
And tell our listener where you came from. You didn't come out of a healthcare practitioner perspective. You came from a different place to NLP.
Yeah, actually, it's a kind of an ironic story. I was not that typical good student. I struggled with English. I was in summer school, I think, 3 years, and ended up going into engineering. Got a bachelor's in electrical engineering, and then spent 21 years in the Fortune 100 industry in IT, product development, voice over IP, a lot of IT technology. My oldest daughter was diagnosed autistic as I was on this journey of linguistics. You know, how does neuro work? How does the neuro brain, what does it all entail? And I've always been fascinated with learning, and with the blessing gift of my daughter, and my other daughter's dyslexic, I just became fascinated and obsessed of learning how neuro-linguistics works.
So from your own life experiences, using your engineering brain and applying it to a whole different area of science, here you are.
Yeah, here I am, exactly.
I know that there are people listening to the show who have heard about NLP and may have a vague understanding, and there are other people for whom we're just using white noise. Now, what is NLP for the people who are not familiar with the concept? And maybe you can give some details for the people who have heard of it but are not quite sure what it's all about. How does it work? What exactly is it?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. NLP, when it was originally developed, it's neuro-linguistics programming. And from the neuro, it's the nervous system. It's the mind through which our experiences is processed via the five senses. So visual, auditory, kinesthetic, olfactory, and gustatory. For those that don't have a vocabulary such as myself, I didn't know what olfactory and gustatory was. That's taste and smell. And then linguistic is the language. All the other nonverbal communication systems through which our neural representations are coded, ordered, and given meaning. So the way we interpret pictured sounds, feelings, tastes, smells, words, that's self-talk. That's where I was fascinated with my daughter being the autistic spectrum. What is her internal representation? How is she perceiving the world? And then having a taste of the NLP allowed me to step into her world to be a better communicator to her. And the programming part of NLP today would probably have been called neuro-linguistic apps, you know, because we all have phones with smart apps. There's not just one process in NLP. It's a combination of all these successful psychiatrists over the last 40, 50 years, and even further back research. Where did they make the biggest impact through communication? So a lot of this was developed back when IBM was around, so they called it programming. Today, they probably would call it apps. The programming is how we've programmed our pictures, our sounds, our feelings, our tastes and smells, how we pictured, how we've programmed the five senses and what they mean to us internally. And then the advance is, how is the person I'm communicating? What's their internal representation? How are they leveraging the five senses? What's the meaning they're making it to them? So ultimately, I believe the reason we would want NLP is to be a better communicator, being able to understand where that person's place is, where my place is, and be able to negotiate and navigate a conversation to fit our need.
And to give this some context, the nurses who are listening to this are very familiar with people who've had traumatic brain injuries. Taking what you just said a step further, when those normal pathways are disrupted and we have to find new ways of communicating with the patient, drawing on their memory, helping them remember things that they used to be able to recall without any trouble. People with frontal lobe damages from hitting their head on the windshield in a car crash, for example, can lose their executive functioning and get lost in the neighborhood or not remember the security code in their keypad mm-hmm. when they come home. We are not talking about that type of programming in this show. Correct me if I'm wrong. We're talking about some strategies for a person who's functioning with all of those things intact and wanting deeper insight in how to connect with other people. That's the framework that we're talking
Correct.
About.
Correct.
Okay. Yeah. I just wanted to set that one up so that we could be clear in what we're saying, because for those who have not heard of NLP, they may be confused unless we talk about the context.
Yeah, perfect. Perfect. Yeah, our world is becoming a fascinating place. I spent 20 some years in the IT industry, and I think all us humans now are on the spectrum a little bit. We all have our own little nuances and our own little programming and our own little meaning to senses and feelings. And yeah, when your nurses are working or engaged with attorneys, they have different education styles, different thought beliefs, different thought patterns, and really being able to understand and appreciate everybody's thought pattern, their view and interpretation of the world, and being able to step into that using NLP techniques, yeah, allows you to be a better communicator. It's not, you know, it's not about something that's damaged and how do we fix it. It's like, we already are where we are, and how do we express that and communicate in a more effective manner?
And when you think about it, David, all of communication is so complex. What we're talking about in terms of recognizing learning styles, for example, just one small piece, you layer on that personality differences. Mm-hmm. I've done podcasts in which we've talked about the bank system, for example, or the DISC profiles, in which we need to be able to recognize how the person that we're trying to connect with perceives our communication. Mm-hmm. If we go to that concept of how we connect with people, legal nurse consultants work with trial attorneys who are sometimes overwhelmed with all of the details of their client's care, if they're plaintiff attorneys, the plaintiff's care. And it's important for us to be able to establish rapport with both the defense attorney and the plaintiff attorney, depending upon who we're working with. Why is that so critical for us from a business sense to be able to use some NLP techniques in establishing rapport?
Yeah, so it's a simple statement. I'm sure I heard it from someone. I don't remember where it came from, but I heard once, like people." So people that are alike, when we have something in common, something we can associate or connect ourselves with, it's a lot easier to break down the walls and actually initiate a conversation. Rapport is everything. You know, I teach a lot of my sales teams, when they're getting pushback from a potential client, it's because they've lost rapport. they've said something that doesn't align with their values, their morals, or their current situation, and you struck a nerve. So rapport is being able to step back out of the situation, not take anything personally, make an actual connection with that person, which it's hard for the generations coming up because they're in their electronics all the time. So actually looking at someone's face, watching their eyes, watching their nose, watching their mouth, watching their breathing, really understanding where that person's coming from. You know, that stuff's very important, because if you've got someone that's in pushback, there's not going to be a connection. There's not going to be a partnership. There's not going to be a transaction of money passed. And they may actually turn around and bad talk you for other potential clients. So to me, rapport is everything. Being able to find that connection of like, and then how do we build upon that?
When I think about that expression, I invariably think about an exhibitor who I met for many conferences, who was marketing to the same group of attorneys I was. And he was a person who took that concept to the extreme. If the attorney would say to him in conversation, you know, my mother's name is Mary, this exhibitor would say, oh, my mother's name is Mary too. And that attorney would disappear, and the next one would come along. Well, what's your mother's name? Oh, Agnes. Oh, my mother's name is Agnes too. And I thought, what? What are you doing here? He went as far as claiming to go to the same college as the attorney. And I thought, you know, there's the concept of rapport can be distorted, and you can get caught being dishonest in doing that. But somewhere along the line, he learned, oh, that you have to develop the affinity concept and make people feel warm and friendly towards you by establishing a connection, even if it wasn't accurate. You're rolling your eyes and making faces. So tell me where that, where's that coming from?
From a psychological perspective, it's an insecurity, right? It's wanted to be connected or brought into the tribe. But, you know, coming from an engineering background, everything to me is energy. We're all vibrating energy, vibrating molecules. We're atoms in space. That's what we are. And when we lie to ourselves, our energy distorts. And when you're trying to build rapport with someone and you're lying to build that rapport, they're going to know. I hit on it a little bit, sensory acuity. You know, our eyes are the gateway to our unconscious mind. We can watch eye patterns. You can watch nose and breathing, and if he's consistent like that, you know, I would love to ask, you don't have to answer this, how many of those attorneys came back and actually did business with him? If the initial engagement is a lie, you know, that is the rapport truly built on a lie, or is there that attorney energetically knowing, hey, this guy's cheesy? We've all had that cheesy sales guy, right? And mm-hmm. It just doesn't feel authentic, and you don't want to be around it. So that's a great question. When building a rapport, it has to be true. It has to be real. You know, searching for the connection, searching for the conversation of that connection, and being authentic about it. It's not a cheesy sales tool. It's, you know, when I try to build rapport, I go right in for truths. Like, one of my things is, what's your favorite cheeseburger? I like mine with, you know, I don't like pickles. I love, you know, mayonnaise and cheese. Who doesn't like cheeseburger? There's a couple of them out there. Hey, you don't like cheeseburger? So it's breaking a conversation to finding a connection. Even if you don't agree, it's probably a conversation we can have, right? Who hasn't had or enjoyed, you know, a nice cold beer or cold beverage with a cheeseburger out on the patio sometime in the point in their life? And it was just, you know, so there's several ways that you can build rapport, but I believe building it on falsities, they're going to know.
Well, I drank so much beer when I was 17 years old that I haven't touched a drop of it since. So you wouldn't find me on the patio drinking beer eating a cheeseburger.
But there was a time you had one, probably.
I've had cheeseburgers before I became vegetarian. Yeah. And I had beers when I was dating an alcoholic boyfriend who couldn't stop drinking. So every date we went on involved alcohol. And when I gave him up, I gave up beer at the same time.
There you go. See, but even there, now I've got two pieces of conversation that I can initiate in. You know, I'm into health and fitness too. I don't know much about the vegan diet or the vegetarian. What's your favorite part about it? know, I don't need you to answer. What I'm trying to say is through my comment, I can be searching for a connection or a curiosity to get you talking. Because when you're working with an attorney or anybody, everything's a negotiation, and I want to connect that. Like when I have curiosity about something, you know, we all love to teach. We all love to talk. So if I can get you to talk, they're like, oh, this guy trusts me. He wants to know more about me. Right. That's one of the processes in getting rapport, building that rapport.
You mentioned a few minutes ago about eye contact and watching people's eyes as a way to get to know more about them or to communicate with them. I know we've been in situations where we've talked to somebody. I can think of an attorney who never made eye contact with me. He searched the ceiling for answers. He looked from left side to the right side, but he never looked directly in my face ever. In multiple times that I interacted with him, and he always made me feel a little uneasy because he couldn't maintain eye contact. And I'm not asking you to diagnose that because I'm still not sure why he could never look. But tell us a little bit more about what we can learn by looking at people's faces.
Yeah, so it's very interesting. This is one of my fascinating parts with NLP. You know, with the daughter I have, her eyes are all over the place. So trying to understand where her thoughts are going, I can now track her eye patterns to see what's going on and not make the meaning of, well, I can't trust this guy because he can't look at me. We have a recall, right? So when I were to ask you a question, and I just saw you doing it a few minutes ago, you kept looking upper right, upper right, upper right. What that means is you're doing a visual recall. It's not in the frontal cortex. It's not in your conscious mind. That's in your unconscious. So when you look up right, you're trying to go down to your database and pull. You're pulling from an experience within a relationship with another attorney. So when I saw you go up right, I'm like, she's in her visual recall right now. If I see you look upper left, you're doing a visual construct. So you might be recalling and then trying to create a story out of your memory. So upper is usually going to be a visual recall or a visual construct. If you see them go lateral, lateral right is going to be an audio recall. So they're listening, they're looking for a sound or a conversation. And then an audio construct would be the left. So if you see them look left, then they're trying to construct what they pulled into a speech back to you. And then the lower rights, right and left, is going to be either an auditory, digital, or a kinesthetic. They're searching a database of either a feeling or they're looking internal conversation. So audio recall is an internal conversation or a kinesthetic, a feeling that they experience. Now, why does this matter? When you're in conversation or in negotiation, you want to speak to your party's language. If I'm asking you questions and you're a visual dominant person, and I'm like, do you hear me? Do you hear me? Do you hear me? You're like, no, I don't hear you. I don't think and hear. I think in thoughts and visions. So by watching eye patterns, you can see where most of their tracking goes to allow you to speak in their language. You know, hey, did you hear what I'm trying to tell you? Can you see what I'm trying to tell you? You know, can you feel it when I'm going through it? So those are three of the primary words we can use by watching eye patterns. Because often when someone tries to talk to us in a non-dominant emotion through our decision-making process, it feels yucky. So when we can listen to their language patterns, are they using the word see, hear, or feel? And then watching their eye patterns can kind of lock in of, oh, this person I'm speaking to is a visual person. I need to be communicating in a visual aspect, painting the pictures, creating the movie. If they're an audio person, I need to be listening to them. Hey, I heard, or I'm hearing, and then watching their eye movements will allow me to say, oh, I need to kind of recall audio remembrance, or how they would remember this is based on audio specific. And then the other one would be a touch or a feeling.
And are those eye patterns true in all cultures, David?
Yeah, it was interesting to see. Now, it can be flipped like the upper right and upper left, and they say a lot. It will flip on recall to construct, but in a lot of times it can flip. A lot of times based on left hand, but it's not always if you're a left-handed person. So there are tests, like when I'm doing coaching sessions, I'll go through some little scripting. They kind of don't know I'm doing it. And we'll get some determination of how their decision-making process is. Just because when I'm trying to influence from a coaching relationship that I'm communicating in the best way that they can receive it. But to answer your question, it's the way that we access the conscious unconscious. It's every human being does it.
Interesting. We have listeners in over 80 countries in the world. So I'm thinking about how those eye patterns might be observable in different cultures.
Yeah. It's like I keep seeing you every time, and then you try to think of a question. I could see your eyes shoot straight up. So you're actually going right into that visual. I'm guessing you're a visual dominant decision maker, right?
That's interesting. Now I will be self-conscious and try to keep my eyes straight on the camera and not move them an iota.
It's so like at the unconscious level, you can't not do it.
Well, you talked about listening to the way that people talk, and I just want to make sure that we got that point nailed down. You talked about hearing cues such as, can you hear what I'm saying? Do you see what I mean? Are you feeling the way that I'm feeling? And those cues being reflective of how that person primarily perceives information. So if I understood you correctly, if you hear somebody say, well, David, let's talk about this plan, and are you hearing what I'm telling you regarding the steps that we should take? You can say back to reflect that understanding, yes, I'm hearing those pieces that you want to put in place. Let's talk about the plan. As opposed to, do you feel it. Like this is a good decision, which is more of a, I guess that would be more of a kinesthetic?
Kinesthetic thinker, yep. Someone that's making decisions based on how it makes them feel. And most of us, we have strategies. Every action we take is based on a strategy. And one of the examples we use of buying a car, you know, how do you know that car is for you? Well, I saw it on the lot. I went and saw the window, and it had all the items I wanted. That's an auditory digital. It's checking my list. Then I drove it, and it felt great. So my decision in that sense to buy a car was I had to see it. It had to auditory digitally meet my criteria, and then ultimately how it made me feel. If someone's a feely person, it's like, well, I wanted to sit in it first. And, you know, maybe, you know, I wanted to sit in it, then I checked it, and, you know, I didn't care about the color, you know, some, you know, it just depends. We all think differently, but when we communicate in a reverse order, or if we don't lead with the one that the feeling that they're dominant with, it feels weird. So when we're in negotiation, this is huge. This is a game changer when you can actually find their language and be able to lead with their communication, their learning style. It's a game changer, especially by maintaining rapport. It's huge in maintaining rapport.
Legal nurse consultants are often involved in negotiations with attorneys on all kinds of issues, many of them related to payment. So just that point alone is huge, to pay attention to the language that the attorney is using, establishing rapport. I found often when attorneys were angry about some billing issue that they needed to know that I heard them. They were almost like big balloons that were puffed up, and they would slowly let the air out as their anger dissipated, and then they were ready to talk, negotiate, listen, entertain a different perspective on the problem. But if they didn't get all that air out, they didn't feel like they had been heard.
Yeah. It'd be interesting. I haven't worked with a lot of attorneys, so it'd be interesting to see a lot of the ways that they make decisions. You know, being a litigator, you're a speaker, but they're also a storyteller. You know, they got to get on stay on with litigation. They got to be asking questions. So they're really quick-minded. So they probably do have a lot of visual and a lot of auditorial aspects, and really honing in with how they're talking to you, you can probably pick up pretty quickly what their dominance lead is.
I've heard attorneys who have said to me how disappointed they were that their cases were settling, because they really wanted to be in the courtroom telling the stories, giving the opening statements, watching the jury, planning their next move, looking at the judge, trying to figure out how the judge is reacting based on rulings and body language and facial expressions, meanwhile getting the witness prepared, planning who's coming up next. It's like a play in which everybody has a part, and there's no room for error. If you make a mistake, all of the planning that has led up to that moment is just shot to hell. Or a witness doesn't perform well on the witness stand, and the whole case can disappear So it's a huge high risk aspect of litigation.
Yeah, makes sense.
And then going to that, the piece of the witness making a mistake on the witness stand, that pulls in part of our population. Some of the people who are listening to this program are expert witnesses who are obligated to get on the stand and be persuasive, authoritative, coherent, use stories and analogies that the jury is going to understand, withstand the pressure of cross-examination. I used to testify for 25 years as an expert witness. Wow. And I would tell people that was the most difficult aspect of what I did was the minute I walked in that courtroom. I liked everything up to that moment. And then that was the price that I had to pay for being good at the analysis and writing the reports and getting the business. Primarily because I don't like conflict, and I learned to be good at withstanding cross-examination, but I never loved it. I never thought that was the highlight of my day. It was always,
right.
How do I get through this? Can you give our listener who is in a high-stakes situation, whether it's testifying or perhaps meeting with an attorney in a tense situation, can you give us any tips on dealing with that anxiety and that tension?
Yeah, no, this was a game changer for me too, because being in an engineering world, high stakes, it's all about, you know, what's between the ears, how quickly you can think, how quickly you can solve a problem, who can come up with the next development, creation, chip design, all that was always in front of us. So there's constant competition. So I totally understand what you're asking me here. And when I went down and got my master's prac, they taught us it's the NLP learning state. You know, we talked a minute ago about the eyes are the gateway to the unconscious. Neuroscience is today showing that we only have, I might get this wrong, but we have limited neurons on our frontal cortex, which we receive 2 million bits of data per second to our frontal cortex. We can only process 126 of those consciously. As we get more nervous, we get more foveal, we get more focused, we get more tunnel vision. As we get more tunnel vision, it connects that communication with our unconscious. Remember how I said we have 2 million bits per second? Well, our unconscious is like a DVR. It records everything. We can only recall 126 bits based on our emotional state in that mind. So if we're in a foveal state, in a focus, tunnel vision, it makes it really hard to get access to all that data. So we call it the NLP learning state, where we kind of go peripheral. We start to open our peripheral vision, kind of focusing on a spot ahead of us, and then getting the sides of our eyes to see out wide. That opens up a clear channel into the unconscious mind. It reduces the anxiety, because now you don't have to consciously remember. You can unconsciously withdraw the information you need in the moment that it's needed. It takes practice.
Yes, it does. And I can think of times that it was an effort to remember to breathe. That sometimes you hold your breath when you're under tension. And I discovered that I have a tendency to do this, and that I need to remember to take some very deep breaths to make sure I've got enough oxygen in my system, because I'm so concentrated on what I'm doing.
Yeah, I noticed it, you know, I had a limiting belief that I was never a good student. And going down, I spent 3 weeks going through the master's, 12-hour days for 3 weeks straight. And it was a constant reminder, all breath. So in through the nose, out through the mouth, relax, go wide. Basically just set your eyes wide and really absorbing the information, being able to process so that you can come back with questions. But this was a game changer for me. I mean, I had some dyslexia growing up as well. I had limiting beliefs that I couldn't learn, some areas where I thought I was stupid. And that's one of the reasons that I love the NLP, because I've learned all these tricks, you know, that I was kind of already figuring them out, but here I went and someone showed me, well, this is why you're good here, this is why you're good there. And then these tricks, it's been an amazing journey.
I'm still thinking about what it's like to be learning 12 hours a day for 3 weeks. At some point, doesn't your head get full and you say, not absorbing anymore. Come on, I'm done.
It's interesting, because I had a huddle with one of my NLP buddies. He's a master as well, and he's actually certified under trainer's training. There's I don't have it in front of me. There's a hypnosis technique in the way that you can teach from hypnotic trance. And it's basically in a state of stories. When you can tell stories and get the emotional attachment, what was neat is the way that I was trained under Dr. Matt James, and he teaches in the hypnotic state. So it's lots of stories. He really engages you. So where at the unconscious level, it makes it easier to remember. That was one of the questions I came back. I'm like, how come I know all this stuff? Like I skimmed the manual when I got back, just in different chapters. I'm like I've got it. Like it's all, and it was like, because it's all taught under like a hypnotic trance. And let me be clear. It's not clucking like a chicken and barking like a dog. There's just, we all go into a hypnotic state or hypnotic trance. Have you ever looked at a fire in a fireplace? Just the flame will put you in a trance. Have you ever walked out of the room into another room and like, why am I here? It's a hypnotic trance. Have you ever driven down the road, gone like 4 or 5 miles, and it's like, oh, where did I just drive? So that's, we all go into a trance state every 90 right. minutes automatically. But there's language patterns that can induce a hypnotic to make it easier to learn, to make you calmer, to be a better communicator.
That would be an interesting way to learn. I love to learn, and I love to see how people put their thoughts together and their communication tools to make learning interesting, engaging, memorable. That must have been quite an experience for you.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. That's what I was talking to him last night. I was like, I would love to do this every day, but we got to get out in the real world and help people with this stuff, because this stuff's needed everywhere.
You're right. You know, it's an inescapable part of life that we all communicate with other people, and there are very few jobs where we are purely communicating with machines instead of other people.
Yep.
Including engineering.
Yep.
And nursing is probably the other extreme of, I've explained to my husband when I was doing staff nursing, in order to be a nurse, you have to be able to communicate with all kinds of people from all walks of life who have all degrees of symptoms and levels of understanding. And you have to walk in, establish rapport, provide patient instruction, get somebody to trust you while you're doing the most intimate things to their body, and to have them convinced that you know what you're doing.
Yeah.
And you do that over and over again every day with every person that you encounter who's assigned to you.
Yeah. Well, this might help your nurses. One of the studies, and I can't remember the lady's name that kind of developed a lot of the NLP works at the very beginning. She's no longer with us, but she used to visit the prisons, you know, early on in the days when they were trying to get a lot of this NLP stuff mapped out. They're like, how can you go visit these bad people? And she replied back, but there is no single bad person on this planet. We are all built in goodness. A lot of us have adopted bad behaviors. So when I approach people as people and as human beings, and the behavior could be inappropriate or poor judgment in that moment in time, that way there's no judgment on the person. I just judge the behavior. And then we talk to the behavior, not the person as being bad. So as a nurse, that would be huge. Any situation you go into, I'm not judging the person as being good or bad. They're just people. What's the symptoms? What's the situation? What's the behavior that's been adopted to cause or create the situation? And talk to that.
And I think that's the way that most nurses judge patients, or they approach patients, I should say, without using the word judge, which is in itself judgmental.
Exactly. So,
well, we have covered a lot today, including the basics of what NLP focuses on, about looking at people's behavior, their facial expressions, their eye movements to determine if they are drawing from memory or they're drawing from feelings, if they're thinking about ahead in terms of planning. We talked about listening to the words that people use, whether they're reflecting thinking or feeling or hearing as a way that they dominantly receive information. We talked about going into the courtroom and dealing with the anxiety associated with what's a high stakes aspect of our profession. And communicating with attorneys who have chosen to work in an area that is intense, high risk, and requires them, as you said, to think on their feet and to be able to react quickly.
Yeah.
David, I know that we could talk for the next 3 hours and not even scratch the surface.
Correct.
How can our listeners find out more about you and the services that you offer?
Yeah, right now my website is davegoodall.com. I'm doing a relaunch with now I've got all my master stuff. The website in the future is going to be tapmental.io. But right now I'm fully accessible under davegoodall.com.
And that's D-A-V-E-G-O-O-D-A-L-L, davegoodall.com.
Correct. You got it.
Perfect.
And Tap Mental in the future will be T-A-P-M-E-N-T-A-L.io.
I've seen a lot of websites lately that are ending in the IO. That's an interesting extension.
Yeah. I don't know. My marketing girl said, that's where you need to go. I was like, okay.
Okay.
I just do what I'm told in that world.
I hear you. Well, thank you, Dave, so much for being a guest on our show. I appreciate that.
Thank you for the invite. This has been awesome. Thank you so much.
And thank you to you who's listening to this program. I hope that you've gotten some tips from Dave in our conversation that you can use. I encourage you to explore NLP. As I said a few minutes ago, we've only scratched the surface and probably like, you know, less than a millimeter we've scratched the surface in terms of what Dave knows and the promises of NLP to help us understand people's behavior and how to connect with them to establish rapport. It's a powerful tool with strategies that can be useful to you in communicating with your clients. Be sure to come back next week and listen to another Legal Nurse podcast and tell other Legal Nurse consultants you know about our show. We are headed towards our fourth year. Our fourth year will be completed in just a couple of months, and we're so happy that you have been part of the journey. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode. Check out Pat Iyer's resources for legal nurse consultants on LegalNurseBusiness.com. Pat coaches legal nurse consultants so they make more money, get more clients, and avoid expensive mistakes. Check out her coaching program at LNCAcademy.com. Please subscribe to our podcast and leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Join our community to get notified of each new episode and to receive the transcript of today's program. Complete the request form on podcast.legalnursebusiness.com. We appreciate you and your interest.